Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Ronald D. Moore, executive producer and developer of the Outlander television series, and we're here to talk about episode 112, Lollybrook. And today we're joined by the writer of this episode, Ann Kinney. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This is a fun one. We talked about this quite a bit at the beginning of the series, just in terms of we knew that eventually the story was going to take us back to Lollybrook and, you know, getting to know Jamie and Jamie's family and the Fraser clan and sort of what that was all going to be about. As I recall, when we first talked about this way, way back in the primeval days of the show, this was it was always a two-parter, and I think our shorthand was episode one was going to be sort of a family drama, and then in episode two, we quickly started talking about bringing the Watch in, but it was, in those days, it was about a plague, wasn't it? Didn't we talk about there being a plague that was, or yellow fever or something?
Oh, yeah, I think we had some kind of, disease, and that Claire was going to, that was episode 13, that Claire was going to somehow be able to heal these guys, and that was, they were holding them hostage, there was a whole thing. Yeah, it was very different. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember why we decided, we felt, I kind of remember thinking that there was some reason that we thought we need a little bit more structure for the second half as opposed to the first half, but I don't quite remember what the rationale that was.
And I think we wanted to pull Ian into that story, and we wanted to pull everybody to get a little more juice out of that, I think was what it was. And this one, was always a family piece. And initially there was going to be more at the beginning. Do you remember, like a big flashback to Jamie and his dad and Ian and as boys?
At the tower, right?
Yes, it was going to be about that whole story about how they had to clean the tower, and and it was a big chunk with them. Sort of a Jamie remembering what it was like to have been with his father and be a boy and that kind of thing.
Yeah, because we were saying the underpinnings of the show were about him trying to live up to the memory of his father, and this was what his father was like when he was a boy.
Right.
And it was also establishing Ian as the friend, and Jenny, and what was it? Because Jenny, they got caught doing something.
I think that they got caught doing something, and then Jenny took the blame for it, and Brian realized it was all just a con on all of their parts, and so he punished them all, and the boys had to clean the tower.
Right.
And I think it was they had to clean the tower because they let her take the blame,
That's what it was. Like, he knew, so
Right. Yeah, because it really was going to be a father-son story. That was really what we wanted to sort of let us know what Jamie's relationship was to his father and what it meant for him to now be the Lord of Lollybrock.
Right.
And also, as you see in the story, how he feels about how his father died and why he feels responsible in some way.
Now, this opening section here with him, right, isn't it? A lot of this, as I recall, is drawn from the book of him asking about the future and so on.
Right. It's one of those places, I think, where Diana, there's a few lines in there about airplanes and that kind of stuff, and we just thought it was so cool and how fascinating that would be for him to wonder about all these amazing things in the future. So, we wanted to play that out. And I really like the idea, too, that I think we kind of laid in here, that Jamie has mixed feelings about, well, and Diana has it too when he sees Jenny, but he has mixed feelings about being home. He's really excited, but it also churns up some not so happy memories for him.
Yeah, I remember this was we struggled a bit with this in post in terms of editing. When you cut to these flashbacks, how it informed Jamie's, feelings getting up to Jenny. I think this was always a little problematic for me in terms of the book is so clear in terms of where he is in time and space when he gets home, because you're kind of with Claire, and she understands Jamie, through her we sort of understand intuitively what's happening when he confronts his sister, and she's shocked, but it all kind of becomes clear, and I was always grappling with how to realize that visually, and this section of it is meant to sort of get you to the place where you understand Jamie's mindset in it. I'm not sure we cracked this entirely.
Right.
Getting to that place where he confronts her at the door. But this, we were certainly trying to get there throughout.
And I think at one point we'd actually had them talking about, the rumor he had heard that Jenny had, given birth to a bastard and that kind of thing, that Randall had raped her. And in one iteration, in fact, we shot it where Claire says to him, but you would forgive her anyway, and he says, yes, I would. And then he walks up and is like really angry with her, and I was glad you cut that out, so much better, because otherwise his behavior doesn't make a lot of sense when he gets here.
think that's the Fraser crest that I think Gary Steele added that. It doesn't actually exist on the property, obviously. This was all shot for episode one.
Hello.
And we just sort of revisited that.
Right. And that episode one, when you shot that whole episode with Jenny, that was the first and only day that actress was there, right? Talk about, hello, welcome, and like, we're going to...
Thank
you,
now go away. I'll see you again someday.
Yeah.
I love Jenny.
She's fantastic.
She's so good.
She's really good. We don't even have him in a kilt here, so that wouldn't...
That's
that,
right. Yeah, we don't even have him in the kilt.
Yeah, because she's wearing it.
Oh, and the whiskey tonight is Jack Daniel's Sinatra again.
It's delicious,
too. It's delicious.
Too.
It's
very
it
nice.
Good?
Yeah, it's
very
nice. Really good. Yeah, yeah. This is one of the scenes that, for me, is part of that learning curve of adapting a book to film. And I love this scene in the book when they first get together and when she ultimately wants his attention. So she reaches through, and I think, as Diana says, it's like fast as a snake. And she goes under his kilt and grabs him by the balls. And I wrote it that way to begin with. And then as we started to actually try to picture how that was going to work, with Jenny, super pregnant, and Jamie, as tall as he is, and how she would get under that kilt and get a hold of him before he would move, it just wasn't practical. So we do preserve the moment, though, by having her threaten to do that.
Yeah, she threatens to do it.
Which I think I thought worked really well.
I have a strong impression you're saying that I play the whore, Captain Randall.
The whore.
The whore. I think that's one of our favorite words.
I know,
the
I love
whore.
It. The whore.
Who's this one? Have you ruined yourself for me? Shame enough, but another one. With no father to give him a name.
And this was tricky, both writing it and the acting, that you don't, you know, you want Jamie to not just be completely unreasonable, and yet you know, understand his position. It was challenging.
Because he has to be somewhat unreasonable, because Claire is sort of the audience's point of view, going, that makes no sense. Why are you blaming her for this? And yet you don't want to lose touch with him. It was a very tricky scene. Very tricky.
Last I saw you, bloodied...
And I think in the book, Jenny is much taller, too. Like,
yes,
she's more... Yeah. They're more equals, right?
I don't know. I think
Isn't
she's little. I think she's little, too. A little bit fierce. Yeah,
I thought she was big.
And that one, too.
And this scene also in the book is, you know, they're in the house and they're having the big fight, and then Claire and Ian are outside while they're continuing to fight. And then again, when I wrote it that way at first, but then when I had Ian and Claire go back in, I realized, wow, so Jamie and Jenny have just been standing here for 10 minutes shouting epithets at one another. It didn't make sense. So again, we put it all out here, which for me, I think, kind of gives you the value of what's in the book without sort of making it strange.
It's a lot of ground to cover here, too, is the tricky part, because you're introducing these people, you're introducing backstories, you know, you're suddenly stepping into complex relationships that most of these characters know. Claire doesn't, so you're aided a little bit that she's the audience's point of view, kind of watching from the outside, but you're still just like reams of stuff are flying past you, and you're always trying to make sure we've slowed down enough that the audience gets these relationships and understand who all the players are. That when Ian steps around the corner, you don't think, is that Jamie's other brother? You know, it's like sometimes I'm watching shows and that stuff, I get confused.
Yep.
And I'll be like halfway into a show and realize, oh, wait, that's his wife.
You know? I wish I would have known that, because then I paid more attention to the front. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And this is more fun stuff, too, how this plays out in terms of the 20th century versus the 18th century and Claire's attitudes. I thought this was really, it was a fun place to do that.
This was a difficult day on the set. I wasn't on the set for most of the shoot, but while we were shooting the interior Lollybrook stuff, this was like a time when the heat on the set got out of control, and we had to shut down and figure out how to cool things down. It's because all the Lollybrook interiors are actually built. Gary Steele, our production designer, built all the interiors of Lollybrook. The exterior is a real location that we go to, but the inside of that building is actually a wreck. You couldn't shoot anything. So all these interiors are on our sound stages in Cumbernauld. And for a variety of reasons, you know, you build these sets, and they're the first time you shoot them, and then you discover things about them. And with, you know, there's candlelight, there's fire, it's a big enclosed set, you're on a soundstage. We were shooting this at a time of year where it wasn't freezing cold for a change outside. And suddenly it got really hot in here, and it got to the point where we couldn't keep shooting. We had to stop and clear the stage and kind of, you know, because people were getting to the point of, whoa, I'm not feeling well. So it was like a problem. So all the actors in these scenes are really sort of literally having stiff upper lips and just soldiering on, getting through this, because they were really uncomfortable. And it took us a while to kind of figure out how to balance the ventilation and all that on the stage.
Yeah, it does get really, really warm in there. I wasn't there for this episode either, but I know in the wedding episode, that same thing with the fire and everything. Yeah. You were envying that they had no clothes on because it was really hot.
Well, and I did that. I was, you know, did my cameo as an extra in the Gathering episode.
Yeah.
And 100 some odd people in that set, multiple fires, multiple candelabras, were all in wool.
Yeah.
And it just, even though, and that day it was freezing cold outside, right. In that set you were sweating and baking and couldn't believe that you were so hot.
It is amazing how much heat is generated by
the
fires and the candles and things.
This is such a disturbing scene.
Ugh.
I love this choice. I don't know who came up with this thing about him putting his finger in her lip like that. It's invasive and disturbing and yet not violent. But it is something about how invasive it is and intimate it is that it really, like, makes you just squirm and you're not comfortable with it.
Yeah, man, Tobias goes for it. He just really, he doesn't seem to have any reservations about being this really creepy guy.
No, Tobias is fearless. I mean, he really just... He commits and goes, and there's you get the sense that he's, if you ask him to go someplace, he's going to go there. And she plays it really well, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because I feel her vulnerability, I feel her fear, but I feel the strength, you know, that I believe that she can look over in that moment, pick up that object, and strike back.
This is a place, too, where the music does an amazing job helping, you know, amp up that kind of anxiety that you're feeling in this scene.
He threw me on the bed and then he stood there.
I don't even know what to say about that. That was, it wasn't scripted, right? And not explicitly,
no.
Like he touches himself.
Right.
And they just went for it on the stage, and I remember seeing the dailies and going, okay, well.
Yeah, I was like, hello.
Let's see how that works.
Yeah.
And then you cut it together and you go, yeah, that actually works. Let's see if anybody says. No comment, never got a note. Everybody went, wow, let's do it. And it felt appropriate to the scene. And it makes this moment work.
Yeah.
We've seen it, now she's seeing it, and now she's making a choice that this is her weapon against him. So it is, to me, it's all connected in the moment. And it's not just, hey, look what we can show on TV. It's
absolutely.
Like
if he had, honestly, if he had just kept his pants closed and just been sort of rubbing himself, she wouldn't.
This wouldn't play.
No, wouldn't play. No, she did a great job. They are both great in this scene.
I don't know why. It was the only thing that came to my mind to do.
It's interesting, too, because we did talk in the room at one point, because as you'll see, Jenny's super pregnant. She's drinking alcohol.
Yep.
And there was a discussion at one point where it was like, well, wouldn't Claire say something to her? And then we realized, no, because in 1945, they were drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes when they were pregnant, too.
You watch, like, Lucille Ball on I Love Lucy. She was pregnant, and she's smoking away and drinking on camera all the time, because that just wasn't where they were.
Yeah, that's often an interesting thing for us, that we think that Claire is modern, which she is, but we have to remember, yes, but she's still from the 40s. She's not from 2015, so to keep that in line.
And I like hanging on to that. I like the anachronism of that to us, and I like just every once in a while making the audience go, wow, she's really not from the 21st century.
Right, which is really cool. I know we were concerned, too, that we wanted to be sure that people believed that he really did walk away without doing anything to her, and that was a big concern. I hope it reads that way, because I believe that is the truth, if she's not lying to him.
That is the idea. I'm not sure it comes through. I think we're missing the piece of him, of her waking up truly, because we kind of cheated it a bit. I did that sort of double exposure, and you kind of see her eyes open. But there's no moment of her, like, clearly looking at her dress and, like, she wasn't violated.
Oh, that's true. That would have been good.
And it would have been better if we'd had a POV shot of her looking down in the courtyard and Jack Randall leaving. But by that point, we were off these locations. We were way down the line. We couldn't afford to go back. We could have spent that money, but there's times when you just make choices not to spend the money because you'd rather spend it somewhere else. And so I think that moment plays, but when I watch it, I'm like you. I'm kind of going, I hope that's clear, you know, that we made that clear.
Right. And I remember we discussed it at the script stage and in the room and all that. And it's funny because I think, when you watch it then, the answer is so simple. Do you know what I mean? Like you think, all she had to do was look at herself or whatever.
Yeah, if she had just sat up and looked at herself.
And realized, oh, man, I'm okay. Yeah. 20/20 hindsight.
Yeah, it's like you get a little distance from these episodes, and then you look at them, and then, that's actually why we couldn't figure that out.
Right.
We're sitting there knocking our heads against the wall.
Well, even when we're breaking a story, I think sometimes we get so complicated in trying to figure something out, and if you have time to go away and come back even a few days, and you think, wait a minute, we don't have to go through all those hoops. We can just get from here to there, and we don't need it, you know?
Well, in a lot of this episode, as I recall, we suddenly got to a place where we felt like it wasn't working, and we went back in and rebroke it and at the last minute, and then it kind of did kind of...
Yeah, when it was in production, we did a lot of rewriting on this thing when it was in production in order to give Claire a stronger story so that she had a stronger through line, what was her attitude. Because Lollybrock, there isn't a lot of conflict at Lollybrock in the book, and we wanted to use the events, but to also make it dramatic, which, as they say, drama is conflict, so we wanted to come up with some stuff.
I think it was the first time in the series where suddenly, and it might have even been Katrina, said, you know, Claire doesn't really have a story here. And I remember that moment of almost like horror, sitting back and realizing, oh my God, that's right, she doesn't have a story here. And I had lost the thread of that idea, everything else going on, and focusing on Jamie and his father and Lollybrock and his brother, his sister and his brother-in-law, and trying to get those mechanics working. And then suddenly it was, oh, but wait a minute, Claire doesn't have a tail. And I remember it's just sort of, oh man, what the fuck have we done? We have to fix this, you know?
Well, because up until this point, Claire, it's her dilemma, she's driving the story, you know, and once we get through the I'm not going back, and we get to here, in the book, you're hearing the story through her, so you feel that she's really involved in it, but then when you step back, you realize, oh no, wow, this is really Jamie's story, and she's just telling us, you know, and that doesn't really work when you're doing the dramatic.
Yeah, because on the book, you're connected to her emotionally and intuitively all the way through. All of her observations are meaningful. All of it is like about Claire on some level, because that's that's the filter you're watching it through. And when we did this, suddenly it was, but what is Claire's story? What is she actually doing? And there wasn't a good answer, and so we went back and retooled it.
And I think it worked fairly well. I think we came up with
I think it knitted together. I think it was the last piece that then made the episode sort of cohere, you know.
Mm-hmm. And it's not optimum to do it that way, but that's, I think we came out. And the other piece of it, as we go forward too, is kind of Jenny's attitude toward her brother, which, when we get to the end, you'll see, which is probably my favorite scene in the piece, is at the graveyard at the end. But I hit on what's going on for Jenny. Why is she being so prickly? What, you know, this guy's been gone for 4 years. What is her problem? And I felt like at the end, when she finally makes that confession, I felt like, that explains it for me. Yeah. I mean, it felt satisfying to me. Again, I hope it feels satisfying to the viewer when we get there.
I love this set. This is their bedroom is truly on the second floor, you know, on the soundstage. We actually built a two-story interior Lollybrock. So they are actually up on the second floor of the structure. And those are tapestries that, I think these are painted tapestries as opposed to woven ones that Gary Steele had brought in. And it's another way of changing up the set. You can pull those tapestries out, put them back in, and change the geometry of the room without really spending a lot of money.
Man, you think downstairs was warm? I bet it was really hot up
this
here.
Was even,
when you go upstairs.
This was hot. Fortunately, there were fewer people up here.
Yeah.
And you notice that they've taken off their coats.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're trying to cool off a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, and this is the sword, the Viking sword. This, I think I always sort of misremember these things in retrospect. I think I added this
piece. Yeah.
Partly because I was watching Vikings and love Vikings. And this was an homage to that. And I was also trying to tie it into, like, this scene later was then supposed to pay off when she comes and rolls him out of bed.
Yes.
And she grabs the sword and says, you know, your father, from your father's father, and so and so. There was something about this sword was a tradition that had been passed down through the ages, and that was supposed to be part of the payoff, was taking command of the sword. So the script goes through revisions and it's in production. And then Diana sent a note just saying, by the by, the relationship between Brian, Jamie's father, and his father was really bad.
Oh, right.
And Lord Lovett would have never given Brian a Viking sword, like in any way, shape, or form. And then we went, oh. And I hadn't tracked that correctly.
Right.
And so I thought, oh, shit. Well, let's not do that. So it can't be this whole generational thing about the sword. So you had to lose that. So then this ends up being, you know, what's sort of what I call a widow in the script, which is a piece of a story that used to mean something else, but still kind of exists. So the sword is sort of still here, but it was meant to pay off later into something that no longer exists.
See, it's so funny that you say that, because I don't know whether I didn't know about that later scene or what happened, because what I love about that moment is it's again the connection between Claire and her past, which is she knows all about it because of Uncle Lam.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really cool, so that didn't really bother me.
And I still like the fact that he goes under the bed and there's the secret thing that dad used to keep there. That's still there. It just I think in my mind it's a bigger widow because I knew where it was supposed to go.
Right. You know, one thing. Also, I think it's interesting too because again, I did a version of that scene and then you, I think, did a pass at it, and it's the father-son thing, which is not my personal experience. So I think there were things in there that I went, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. I haven't had that experience, but it feels real, which is the nice thing about having so many of us that we can inform each other on that stuff.
Yeah, because it's always good when you have a diverse and dynamic room, because every writer brings a different life experience and idea to what you're doing.
Now, I have to say, this scene... had we had this scene always existed in the script, and I think if we'd had, my intention was, if we saw him with young Jamie at the beginning, then how heartbreaking this would be when we see him.
Exactly.
You know, and I think it's still emotional, but I think it would have been more emotional if we'd had seen him as dad with a little boy.
Yeah, because now it's his introduction, but then he's gone so quickly.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. He was disappointed.
And this is obviously a key moment in the development of their entire relationship.
Yes.
Now, I'm trying to remember in the book where we learned. I think we learned this story earlier, like at a different... Did she tell this to Claire way back at Castle Leek about his experience being flogged, and we moved it to this section of the book?
It's possible. I can't remember. I know that we knew we had to have it in there, given where we go at the end of this group of scripts.
Yeah, it had to be.
We had to lay that in. Because up till this time, we don't realize that Jack Randall has a thing for Jamie.
No, that component is not there until this episode. And I don't remember when he revealed that to Claire in the book. Because it's obviously, I mean, in the book...
This scene is from the book.
It's absolutely from the book. I just don't remember when he told her that part of the story.
Mm-mm, I don't remember either. It might have been... It might have been at Lollybrock, honestly.
It might have been at Lollybrock?
Yeah, I think it might have been. Well, maybe not. I don't remember.
You had me flogged and you to death. Didn't understand it, couldn't I? Imagine what he was talking about now.
This is always fun too when they, because even when you know how it's done, it's still magical to you. I mean, even for me, obviously they're on a set, and at some point we cut and we see what he's looking at outside, and you know that those things aren't even in the same place. But it's amazing how it works.
It's the illusion of that light. It reads as legitimate exterior daylight.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not too bright. It feels like it's probably a slightly overcast day, and it's just so natural and just feels really true.
And that stuff is all very carefully calibrated too. When you're on the set, man, and the DP and the gaffer and tweak it a little bit this way, tweak it a little bit that way, it makes a big difference.
And you have no idea what they're talking about.
None.
Like the writer producer sitting in the director's chair, and you're watching and observing, and they're speaking in essentially a foreign language.
Yeah. Although we play this game on the set sometimes where you look around and you go, okay, if you work on the set, what job do you want? And I would like to be the gaffer.
Would you?
I don't remember. Because it's just so interesting how it's, you know, it's almost like he tips his head like a cat, you know what I mean? He's looking and he's really just a little tweak there. It's so specific. It's really, I think that would be fun, yeah, and it makes a big difference. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, for me, if not the director, which is the one I just would gravitate toward, setting that aside, I would want to be a cameraman. I would like to physically look through the lens, through the eyepiece, play with the frame, and you know, that fascinates me, is the eye it takes to do this, because you can always tell a good cameraman and a bad. It makes such a difference, you know, in a film or in a television show, how they, when they move, where they frame it, you know, and it's all just really, really fine stuff.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, see, for me, a director, I would kill myself. I would never want
to. No, really? You were never tempted to?
Never.
Not even once?
Never.
I didn't do it for a long time. I didn't do it until last year, Galactica was the first time.
Yeah, and you liked it.
I did it. I was terrified, and I just thought, if I'm ever going to do it, this is the time I should do it, because it's the last year of a show that I run, and I know everybody, and they're all going to make sure I don't screw this up.
Right.
And it was just oddly relaxing.
Was it really?
It was real. In all honesty, it was
interesting.
I found it really almost like a Zen experience, because, you know, what I do now and what you do is so many things. It's like juggling this script and that storyline and this email and that notes call and looking at this cut and all these different things. And when you're directing, all that goes away, and this is the only thing I'm doing today is shoot just this. Just do this. And they don't want you to do anything else.
Right,
they go out
right.
of their way to not have you leave the set. They bring things to you. Oh, you want to eat? Here's a sandwich, you know?
Wow.
Here's a cup of coffee. Please don't leave the set. You know? Just do this. Don't look at your email.
Yeah.
Just do this. And there was something really freeing and very, like, you know, very relaxing about it.
Oh, this is always so hard to watch.
I know. This is like right at the edge of what I can tolerate to look at.
Yeah. No, it's funny because in the room I'll talk about different TV shows and I'm saying, oh, I can't watch that show because it's just too violent. And then everybody looks at me and is like, really? Have you watched some of these scenes in our show? This is a hard one to watch. Ugh.
Yeah, this is right. I've said this before. This is right at the edge of what I can tolerate.
Yeah.
Because I don't like to watch a lot of violent stuff either.
I always think that must hurt Sam's arms to be hanging there.
Yeah, don't you think?
Yeah,
it must.
Yeah.
You must have had to do it often enough and for long enough that it would be really.
Plus, I think it would also be really unsettling to, even though you know it's you're in a TV show, to be strung up like that would be.
Yeah, to feel
super
constricted
and vulnerable.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, that would be hard.
Oh, the most horrible thing when I watch shows or movies is when I'm watching an actor who's lying in a coffin.
Oh, really?
And they lower the lid.
Yeah.
I just want to jump off of the couch. It freaks me out, the idea that you're on that set and they lower that coffin lid.
Yeah.
It's like, oh man, I could not. It would just wig me out. No, I'm just going to blow the tank. You know, there's no way I'm doing this.
You know, it's funny what you're saying about being a director, too. I think that's certainly the difference between your job and my job, because that experience of being able to just do one thing is what happens to me when I write a script.
Oh, yeah?
Well, because I can watch cuts and stuff, but that's my job when I go off to write a script is just all I'm focusing on is that script. And I love that. Hours go by, you know, when it's hard, but you start on it and then you look up and go, oh, wow, I've been doing this for 3 hours and I didn't even know. Or I just go into a zone where you just sort of picture it and it's not quite channeling it. I wouldn't say that, but I love that feeling. It's really liberating. And
yeah, that's a space that's hard for me to get to. I think
in
some ways, maybe because of the way I started. When I started at Star Trek, I stepped into a show that was in such chaos and so much turmoil, and I didn't know any better, and I just was, this is life. And we were gangbanging scripts and each of us writing an act or you writing our scene and rewriting that one, and there was this, you were never just working on your piece.
Yeah.
You were always getting pulled out to somebody else's break, somebody else's this, somebody needs a pass on this, or they're going to do a pass on that, so there was always this sort of chaos of the writing experience. And the times when I'm able to sit down and write, on some weird level, if it's too quiet, it almost makes it harder. I've kind of gotten used to the interruption and the, okay, you've got an hour.
Right.
See if you can get a page or two out in this hour, or I'm on the plane and I've got a little bit of time here. It's always broken up into all these little pieces of time.
Yeah.
And when I was in between shows and doing development and writing a script, there were literally times when I had the whole day just to write this, And I would be depressed and unhappy and kind of screwed up.
It was, that's so interesting.
And then I would later go, wow, that's really messed up that's where you are, that you now need
chaos
and a bit of tension and a bit of anxiety and a bit of worry to actually produce. And if you have space and time and quiet, you're actually not comfortable with it. It's just not, I don't think that's a good place to be, but that's kind of.
Well, because that's what is so great about this show. As crazy as our season is so long, I mean, what a luxury. You know, I get to go off and I'll get a week or a week and a half to write an outline. I'll get 2+ weeks to write a script. It's fantastic. Because usually...
You're
boom, boom, boom. And when you're out writing and then if you have a... You know, you're waiting for notes, you're back in the room breaking somebody else's story and then you're back and forth and back and forth. And this has been an incredible luxury that way.
Yeah, I know. We get so far ahead of scripts and are so proud of ourselves. And then the UK crew looks, because they run on a completely different time schedule. They're used to writers coming in, delivering the entire series ahead of time before they shoot a frame, and then they just go off and shoot it.
Yeah.
And with us, they're like, what do you mean you're only 3 scripts ahead? My God, you guys are behind. And we look at them like, are you insane? Do you not know how lucky you are that we're not generating an outline the day before you shoot?
Exactly. And you're prepping off an outline, and you're, or you're getting pages as you're shooting them. No, it's a real luxury. It's really nice to do it this way.
This scene right here where... this is leading to her, where she sees the kid get slapped, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to come back to it in a minute. That was one of the few times I went out to the location at Lollybrook, and I have this sort of sense of by the time I get out there, they're on the last shot. Because I drove all the way out there from the studio, which is like a good hour or whatever. I'm going to go to the set. I really want to go to the set today. Let's go. So then schedule. All right, I'm going to the set. I'm getting all the way out there. Slap the kid. We're wrapped. Let's go. And I'm like, oh, God damn it. Really? Again?
Oh.
More?
No. I'm good. Thank you. If I didn't have to drive...
You do have to drive.
I do have to drive. Yes.
I just have to roll home.
There you go. Well.
Apologies, but we lost one of our cows to sickness 2 months ago.
This whole quarter day thing is drawn from the book, right?
Yeah,
this was
absolutely.
Always part of it. Oh, and this jacket. I think Terry, my wife, costume designer, has a story about this jacket. I think that is the jacket that Jamie's wearing, the coat in this scene. This leather jacket is literally Brian's jacket. That's his father's jacket. And if you looked back and looked at the earlier scene when he's at Fort William, he's wearing that. And then this was like a thing of Jamie literally putting on his father's clothes.
Oh my God, that's so cool. I didn't know that.
It's a nice little subtlety.
Very cool. I mean, that's the other thing. One of the things that's very cool about any of these productions is that everybody's work is working toward the whole.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember reading about Chinatown and how the set designer always wanted Jake Gittes to be walking uphill. Because it was always an uphill battle for him. And when you watch the movie with that in mind, it's fascinating. It's not necessarily a giant hill, but he's always moving uphill. And just that subconsciously then, as a viewer, you're taking that in.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. That's
so cool, any of that stuff, or again, the costume, you might not notice it consciously, but subconsciously you may have noticed that and that just works on you, which is really cool.
Yeah, this is where I showed up. I showed up, I think, on this side. They're losing the light. And I think we should... It was like Claire's last piece of coverage. And then, okay, that's it. Thank you, everyone. Yeah, right there. He walks off. Okay, thanks.
This is one of those pieces of casting, too, that sometimes you write a scene and you see 10 auditions. And you get to the point where you think... okay, this scene doesn't work because none of these actors is landing it. It's just not working. It's not working. And then somebody walks in and they nail it. And you realize, oh, okay, the scene works. I just had to get the right actor for it. And because this, we were, people were too mean or they were too soft. We just couldn't get it to work. And I think this guy does a great job. He really hits the mark.
Casting is a strange and mysterious process.
Oh my God.
I have no idea what makes it work. Because there's so many times I've watched actors come in, usually for guest roles, they come in and they're terrible in the room and then they'll nail it on camera and vice versa.
Yeah.
And you're sick, because sometimes they're just bad auditions. There's just the actors that come in and can't audition to save them their lives.
Yep.
And then there are the actors that give brilliant auditions and you get them in front of camera and they totally just space out. And
yeah,
it's so,
and you think, wait, just do it just like you did in the audition.
Yeah, you did it. You nailed it, dude. Just do that again.
Yep. Yeah. That's also interesting, too, with auditions, because some of the actors will come in sort of dressed for the part, which is always interesting
yeah.
to me.
Oh, yeah.
It's interesting to me that neither of us said, when you said, what job do I want on the set, neither of us said, I want to be an actor.
No. No, I never wanted to be an actor.
Wow.
It's intriguing on some... I enjoyed, like, doing plays in high school and that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. and I liked doing comedy and getting having an mm-hmm. audience laugh. I can see the addiction of that.
Yep.
That's really special.
Yeah.
But, man, to walk into those audition sessions cold, and we're all sitting on the other side of that table drinking water and watching our Blackberries and iPhones, and then okay, and scene, and they're gonna like cry or they're gonna yell or gonna have a whole emotional thing, and then it's over and we all go thank you
yeah, that's great, thank
you. They walk out the door and you go, too tall, too short, too fat, too this, too that, and it's completely superficial on the first round.
Absolutely. No, I have friends who are actors and they'll call and say, maybe if I'd done this or that, and you know I've had situations where either there was a pissing match between the casting director and the director, so they were never going to agree, or it'll be things like, oh God, she looks like my first girlfriend and yeah. I really hated her.
I know.
And you're like, that poor actor, there's nothing they could have done to get over that.
Like, that's so unfair.
Yep.
It's such an unfair, it's an unfair business, but to be an actor, oh my God.
Well, and I often think, like, as a writer, you know, you submit your scripts and there people are either going to accept them or reject them. But I'm not sitting in the room
yeah.
while they're reading it yep. and they look up at me and go, no, thank you.
Yep.
You know what I mean? There's a little distance.
They're not rejecting you.
Right.
There's at least one piece of separation.
Yes. Yes. This would be really hard.
I think it's really hard for them to do what they do. And the distractions and being in that moment. You know, these two, you know, they're playing this intimate, quiet scene at night, you know, as if there's no one else in the world. And there's 50 people standing around.
Yep.
Surrounding them over and doing it over and over again and having to yep. get to that same place over. It's remarkable. I don't know how they do it.
Well, not only that, but they're doing the scene, but they also have to be sure that they land in the right place,
yep.
that your face is turned just right so that the light hits you right. I mean, I don't know how you keep all those things in your head and actually act.
Yeah, because I'll sit in post and I'll bitch and complain because somebody forgot to, you know, they raised up their glass on that line and they didn't do it on the second take, but... reality, remembering
yeah.
that while trying to not act at the
yeah.
same time.
No, it would be really hard. I have to say, these two, I love them. Katrina's fantastic.
She's fantastic.
And, you know, in that scene, she's mad at him, but that smile at the end takes
yeah.
kind of the stink off of it, which I just think she's just fabulous.
She's fabulous. This is a really good episode for him. I think
mm-hmm.
this... it's a really good Jamie episode, you know, homecoming, his family, who he was before he met her, trying to sort of reconcile all that. I really watched that play out with Sam here, and I think
mm-hmm.
it's a really good episode for him. I love all this little hangover stuff. He doesn't
mm-hmm.
overplay it.
Yeah, no, it's really fun.
There's the dog.
I love that her answer is to give more alcohol.
Yeah.
That's really...
Do you want another drink, Ron?
Oh, yeah, I'll have a little bit more. It's like, you know, Claire, the nurse, the medical professional, the hangover answer is the hair of the dog.
Yep, that's right.
Aunt Yia, she said yourself.
They do a lot of drinking in this show. There's
a lot of drinking
no
in this show.
No question.
And how easy do you suppose your tenants will be when the whole estate goes under because we can't make ends meet?
Perhaps we should postpone this to see.
I like this scene.
This with another
this is a good
scene.
What are you on about, Jenny?
Ravi McNabb, his father, threw him out thanks to you. He said if Jamie Fraser thinks he can be a better father, he can damn well pay for his upkeep.
Now, did we talk at one point, did we have a version where we saw Jamie go out and beat Ravi's father or not?
No, I don't think we ever
did.
I don't think we had one where we actually saw him.
Yeah, we always heard about
him. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And for me, writing these kinds of things, like this whole speech that she gives, it's a lot of information that she has to give, and it's a real challenge, and it's satisfying when it works. I have to get a lot of exposition out here and to do it in a way that's entertaining and interesting,
yeah.
which I think. And again, the actors are fabulous. And this is where, as I said, where she's got so much attitude toward him and you understand why she's annoyed, but there's always this undercurrent of like, but why is she so annoyed with him? And
yeah.
I love, again, at the end, and it's one of those moments where you see it, hopefully, and go, oh, now I get it.
Yeah.
This is Crook.
This is Crook. That's
this
like
is Crook.
Whore.
The whore.
Yes.
Yes.
My sister's a whore. This is Crook.
I love this set. It's so cool that the door is a secret door.
Great?
Yeah. And Gary does, they do all kinds of research. I mean, this is actually what it would look like, right?
He did a lot of research into this period. You know,
did somebody paint all that stuff on there? Is that
I think
how
they painted all of that. Man. All of that has been hand done by people. But, you know, then I don't know. You know, did they buy the chairs? Did they make the chairs?
Wow.
Did they buy the table? You never quite know. And I'll walk on the set and they'll always surprise me about what they made and what they rented, which is really great.
Now, Toni Graffia was, she was on the set for this episode, and she was telling me that they found this mill, which they thought was really, really cool, but the only problem was, as you see, we need a pond, and there wasn't a pond. It was just a stream that went from the mill. So they actually built a dam, our production people, so that they could dam it up and
really?
Let it fill up so that it was deep enough that he could actually duck down under the water.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. There's a moment coming up here that I love what he says. Right here.
I am sure that water is so cold.
Oh, she said it was freezing.
It must have been so cold.
Yeah.
There is no body of water in Scotland that is warm ever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And again, the actors are so game that he would get down in that water, that freezing cold water.
They're tough. They're just tough. They'll just do it. They don't complain. They just go for it. Because he had to be in that water for hours.
Yeah.
Just a long time.
Yeah.
Over and over again.
Yeah. Now, in the book, the scene is with Granny McNabb.
And
so we took the scene because we love the scene, but then put Jenny in it.
Yeah.
Which I think was a fun thing to do.
Was it always at a mill? It was always at a mill, right?
Always at a mill. He, in the book, he wears red underwear.
That's right. Red long johns.
Which were, I think, a little anachronistic.
Yeah, Terry said there were no red long johns. You realize that.
Right. And then we also felt like, in terms of the character, he says something about, I'm wearing them because I wouldn't want to be naked in front of all of my tenants and stuff.
Tenants, yeah.
And what we were also thinking is, we know that we've established that Jamie is self-conscious about all the scars on his back. He's talked about how I don't want people to feel bad for me. So we thought, well, all right, between those two things, maybe it makes more sense for us to put his shirt on instead. That that's what he would want to cover as opposed to his behind. So, I thought that worked pretty well. And all this is the same out of the book, but instead of the underwear, it's a shirt.
Yeah, it's a shirt.
You know.
Perfectly good shirt. How on earth did that get stuck into the mill?
I like this whole notion, too, that the Redcoats are not necessarily villains here. They actually come, and they genuinely try to help. They're sort of like, oh, you're having a problem with the mill, let us try to help. And I really like that.
Well, and then also you establish that these people, too, aren't soldiers all the time. That this guy, the other guy says, you know, his father runs a mill. There's nothing he doesn't know about mills. I mean, that was all really fun.
That had to be so cold.
So cold. Oh, my God.
He has to stand up out of the water into the wind. How many times?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
Hypothermia is just, like, hovering around the edges here. Not to mention the back prosthetic and the scar. Ugh.
Now, the prosthetic for this, do you do anything in post to make that look different?
What we do is we'll look at it and we'll see if any of the edges are showing, because it's an appliance that covers the back and it's sort of, you know, a big applique. It's a big planton. Mm-hmm. So the edges, after a certain amount of time of wear and tear, you'll just start becoming aware of them. So digitally, we'll go in and kind of blur those edges. But the actual sort of scars themselves are 98%. Practical that are done by our makeup department.
Mm-hmm. It takes a while to put those on, too.
It takes like an hour or two. I mean, it's a long process. This was a whole thing. Getting these paintings done, shooting that. This scene floated for a while because we kept running out of time, and do we really need this scene? And, you know, I felt like it was important. That, you know, it gives Ian something to do. It was important for their relationship. It informs why Claire's goes back in. But this kept, like, floating around the schedule, and people kept saying, do we really need that thing with the paintings? And the, you know? And then there was a whole drama about the paintings, and are the paintings right, and are the paintings period correct, and do they look enough like people? And it was just like, you know, one of those things you put in a script that should be simple, you think should be simple, and ends up taking an inordinate amount of your time in discussion about the paintings in the fucking hall.
I know, it is very funny. Sometimes you just throw something in a script and you don't realize what chaos you have created.
You have no idea.
When I first started, I remember writing a scene where somebody was supposed to be, it was a flashback to the 70s, and they were going to a prom. I'm just right away, I go, and he's wearing a powder blue tuxedo. And then the discussions about where are we going to find that tuxedo and powder blue? Should it be blue or should it be dark blue? And honestly, my feeling was, make it look like the 70s. Yeah, I don't care what color. But everybody, again, they took it very literally. That was the first time that I realized, oh, wow, when I write something in here, people are paying attention to it. Or you hope they are.
Because you think on one level, oh, you're the writer, you've written it, and nobody cares. And on the other level, suddenly they'll focus on one weird description that you threw in because you were just looking for something, you don't care, and hours are spent and work.
Right. Although the flip side of that, sometimes you throw things in, and in your mind it's like, well, this is a suggestion. This is to sort of get you going in the right direction. And then there are other times when you want something very specifically. How is anybody going to know which is which? You know, you just sort of assume they're going to know.
Yeah, and it's all the things of your expectation of the scene that you let go of, you know, early on. I remember having a while to get over the idea that in my head, they're walking in from camera left, and they're sitting down on this line. And then you see the dailies, and they came in from camera right, and they're standing on this line.
Ah, that's interesting.
You know, and it's like you had to divorce yourself from the mental image of your movie to what it could be to what it actually is going to end up on the screen.
Yep, absolutely. Otherwise, you drive yourself crazy.
I mean, do you play the movie of how this is going to be shot in your head?
Absolutely. I see it in my head, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, it's on the really good days, it's better than what you imagined. As one guy I worked with said, they beat the page. It's better than that. They beat the page. But yeah, it's hard to let go of that sometimes.
It is. It's really hard to let go because you're trying to deliver an idea, and then you feel like no one gets what I'm trying to do here.
Yep.
But those magic times when it's better than the page is just unbelievable.
Oh, it's fantastic. And it's everything. I mean, it's the actors and the costumes and the choices that are made. You just think, wow, that's better than I could have ever imagined it.
That's when you really start going, wow, it is a big collaborative medium. There's so many.
No question.
And there's that weird thing where sometimes on a production, it all comes together. All the departments and all the hundreds of people suddenly like focus and they give you this one piece of gold.
Yep.
And then you're on other productions where you just can't possibly get all the things in the same place at the same time.
Yes. Those are the ones you don't want. This isn't one of those, though,
this
so that's good.
Yeah.
But if he were
here, this was the scene they used to have the Viking sword in it. She used to then go and had a whole thing about it. And this sword was given to you by your father, and it's your. And that was the sort of the point of what this was about. And then, no, can't, don't do that. So cut that out. The scene still works, and it works emotionally.
So did you cut it at the script stage, or was it already shot?
No, it was at the script stage.
Yeah.
She caught it at the script stage, and I went, oh, shit, we can't play that. So we cut it out. But I didn't go back and take it out of the first scene. So now that's why it tortures me. It's like, oh, right, that was supposed to set up that.
Right. I'm so glad you did, because we've just been breaking the Lord Lovett scene and story in
for season two.
And it's, it won't work if you thought they had a good relationship.
Yeah, because I wasn't thinking.
No.
That's the, I mean, Diane has many values in the show, obviously. But, you know, she is that one that's totally outside that can sometimes say, hey, you know, this actually connects to an important thing there.
Right.
And then you realize, oh, shit. I'm touching the mythology here. Wait a minute.
Yep.
On a minor point, a really small minor point.
Yeah, yeah. I love, this is my favorite scene.
This is a great scene.
Yeah. And this one sort of stayed the same throughout. Sometimes things change and change and change, and then there'll be a handful of scenes that from the beginning to the end, they're the same. And this was pretty much the same. It moved around in the script, but it was...
Yeah, this was always the scene. And I remember when I saw the first cut on this, I went and watched this in the editing bay in Cumbernauld, because we have a post-production facility there. And if I'm in Scotland when the director's cuts are ready, I'll watch it there as opposed to in Los Angeles. And they were still shooting something else with Jenny, probably, I guess, the second episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched it in the bay. And watch this scene in this episode. And this scene moved me. This scene, touched me. And I'll still, if I was paying attention, this would still kind of, I would get misty on it.
Yeah.
When she says, Welcome home, Lord Brock Turok. It just touches me, and her performance touches me. And I remember going out, and they were still shooting, and Laura was on the set, and I went and found her, and I said, I just watched 112, and I gotta tell you, you are special, because you are special, and she is special, and there was something about this performance and this moment, and this moment that just moves me. It's rare, that quality of an actor and material and a moment in time that can take you to a place, and that's what
we're all doing.
That's what we all did. That's what we're trying to do here.
Yep, absolutely.
When I saw the scars on your back.
Yeah, again, I love in books and TV, anything where you get to a place where you connect all the dots.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt like happened here. Great.
This to me makes the entire show work.
Yeah,
this,
me too.
This is the show.
That day when Randall came here.
And she believes it, and you're connected to her.
If I hadn't mocked him that way, if I'd given him what he wanted, he wouldn't have...
It's touching him. It's like,
oh,
yeah. You're just totally there.
And she's sort of saying to him what he said to Claire, yep. And that helps him. I was very happy with how this
turned out.
When
he grabs her right there, when he reaches out, it's like you just so want to grab her that quickly, because yep. She's just like collapsing, and oh my God, you got to grab her like,
yep.
That fast.
Yep. And then we come up to a piece that's just lifted right out of the book, which I always loved. And it's funny, because you do have those places in the book where you're like, oh my God, I got to figure out how to get this in there.
Yeah,
I
how
love
do you get
this.
To this place?
And it's coming up where she just...
It's not your fault. Mine either. There's a devil in that man no one can influence.
And yeah, we're really setting up Randall, which
is really good.
You're
pointing towards where we're going.
Yeah. Yeah, she's so good in this.
Oh, she's so good. And he's right there with her.
Yep.
He's like so in this scene.
That's always interesting to see, too, when you see actors and you can see them when they're really working together.
Yeah.
Well, they'll talk about a generous actor where they're really in the scene as opposed to I'm doing my performance and you're over there.
Yeah, you really feel that they're alone and you're almost like eavesdropping on their private moment.
Yeah, which is great. This part.
You're telling me that may not love you as much as you love me, because if you are, Jimmy, please, I'll tell you right now, it's not true.
Yeah.
And I love that, how it turns the scene, too, so it goes from being, you know, really kind of sentimental to just...
To funny, to, you know...
Welcome home.
Oh, that kills me.
Yeah.
I love that.
Aww.
Oh.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, and then you wish you were there and you got to be there with them. Yeah. It's really nice.
I love that. It moves me. It moves me every time.
Oh, my God. The conversations about this gravestone.
Oh, about the gravestone?
Were you part of that?
I heard, yes. The endless conversations about the gravestone.
What is it going to say? And, you know.
Oh, yeah, God.
And that's one of those things you talk about putting in the script. It's like, and then we, you know, and Brian's gravestone is there. And then you don't realize the can of worms you've opened, which has been, you know, and it's, yeah. And I think it's all in Gaelic, too, isn't it? Wasn't it?
It is all in Gaelic.
It was like, for the 1,400 people who could even read that, it was crazy.
It's all in Gaelic. And that tower, endless talk about the tower.
Oh.
How far is it from the house? And I remember looking at maps and, you know, layouts and where's the tower and what can you see of the tower? And at a certain point, you're like, it doesn't fucking matter.
Yeah.
Just put the tower
just anywhere. It's fine. It's fine.
I just don't care anymore.
Yeah. Because obviously, it's not actually outside this this window. So,
this is a lovely scene between the two. And there's a part in the, there's a line in here that's also a line that I said to my wife that I inserted into this scene.
Because a lot of this is right out of the book, too.
A lot of this is right out of, but there's a line he says where he says, I loved you more than the day before.
Yeah.
That's something that I said to Terry a long time ago that's engraved on one of the things I wear around my neck. And so I put that in the scene specifically for her.
I just never knew you were such a mushball, Ron.
I am a mushball.
I
came
my thighs and
that
rock, so it did something to me in the chest.
Yeah, this is all from the book.
That's why you agreed to marry me.
This is one good long take, too.
Yeah. Oh, is it? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, this is. We're just holding on this because they were in it.
I wanted you from the first moment I saw you, but...
They have, these two have such great chemistry.
Oh, when they're in it, they're so there.
Yep.
Now, I wake up every
There you go. Yeah. It's fun when you can put stuff like that in too, you know what I mean?
It is
from
nice,
your own
isn't
experience.
It?
Yeah, yeah. It's really nice.
I love you.
That's the first time she says that to him.
That's the first time. And there was some debate about where she should say that to him.
Yep.
You know, because there was I think it was even shot in 111 in the witch's hole.
Oh, may have been. Yes, yes, yes.
That, Gayla says, "Do you love him?" And I think she answered and said, "Yes, I do."
Right.
And I cut it, and I remember there was some debate about it, and Tony and network and studio that she should say it, and I didn't want to say it. I wanted to hold it for a moment when she would say it to him.
Yep. Yeah, because I think it is. It's the progression of their relationship that she's finally committed to this, which is great. And then just when things are going so well for Jamie and Claire,
when you say it's going to be the Waltons.
Yep.
And they're going to live here at Lollybrook, and we're going to have wacky little adventures, and it's all going to be okay.
Yep. Not so fast.
What?
And this was one of those scenes, too, that I had this at the end of my script, but it had to feed right into the top of Tony's script, so there was a lot of back and forth on how are we going to make those things, because you come in at the top of 13 right here, right?
Yeah, right here. It's a direct pickup.
This is another one of those days when it was super hot on the set,
this is really hot. This is like a difficult moment.
And there we go.
There you go. There you have it. 112.
Very exciting. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, a good episode.
Thank you for
joining us. Thank you all at home. We will see you again next week for 113, The Watch. Until then, good night and good luck.
Good night.